you've got to take the risk. As Mark Cuban says, you got to have the balls to make the baby. So if you don't, you're not going to ever do it. So I don't know what else to say other than
go. Welcome to Multifamily Rockstars. If you are new to apartment investing or already experienced, you will enjoy this show. You will hear from the leading experts in multifamily real estate so that you can be a better owner, operator, and investor. Real people, real stories, life-changing. And now, your host, Ryan Christopher Nunes.
Welcome to Multifamily Rockstars. Today's guest is Mike Woodfield. Mike is the COO and partner of Obsidian Capital based in Austin, Texas. Over the last 5 years, Mike was the lead asset manager overseeing nearly $300 million in multifamily deals. During that time, Mike was responsible for the renovation of 2,200 multifamily units totaling $20 million in improvements, which created millions of dollars in value add. Mike has experience in executing turnarounds for underperforming assets and over 7 years of operations and marketing experience across multiple industries. Mike, thank you for being here today.
Hey, thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
Awesome. Well, I heard you speak on another podcast and it was phenomenal. So that's how I found you. So I hope our listeners really enjoy this podcast with you. Awesome. To kick it off, why don't you just walk us through your background and tell the listeners a little bit about yourself and how you got
started? Absolutely. Yeah. I wasn't the best student ever growing up. I enjoyed school for the social aspects of school. And I got to meet some girls. That was fun at college and all that. I didn't really have a specific focus, though. And I constantly found myself trying to find ways to make money rather than go to class. So I had a lot of side hustles and little businesses that I started in college. And I've always been kind of just an entrepreneur. My whole life, if I look back, I started my first business. I did lawn aeration. I knocked door to door. And I did that when I was 11 years old. And, I had a window washing business, you know, and all this stuff, you know, in college. Anyways, when I graduated school, which I did, thank you, Mom. You did your job. When I graduated college, I took a job with a private equity firm out of Chicago. And they executed turnarounds of failing businesses. So they would go in and they would find a struggling operator and they would say, hey, we can fix your problems. Just give us, you know, majority control of your business basically. And we'll run it. And they did that with a company. And I came in as the boots on the ground. So I was the operations manager for them. And we turned around that company and had a great exit there. And as I was exiting that company, I had some options to continue on with this company, but my business partner now, Glenn, he's been in the multifamily industry for like 30 years. He did property management and about a decade ago decided to get on the ownership side. And he called me and said, look, like if you're an operations guy and you have the skill set, you would be a great asset manager for my multifamily portfolio. And I was like, well, you know, it's kind of jumping into a different industry and this is 7 years ago. But I took the leap of faith into the multifamily industry and I got all my experience there kind of under his tutelage and his mentorship. Since then I've been able to get my CPM designation, and oversee about 300 million in multifamily, about 5,000 units that we've renovated in value add. More recently, the last 2 years, Glenn and I have partnered. We've formed a company called Obsidian Capital. And him and I are 50-50 partners. And everything we do now, we split, which is fun for me to get on the ownership side. And we're doing about 500 units in development right now. We did 3 value-add projects last year. And we have our first kind of core deal that we're doing and closing next month.
That's so awesome. That's great. Yeah. Well, very cool. I think we'll start on the operations side. So, you know, it sounds like you had a lot of success turning around different businesses and Multifamily is effectively a business, each property. And so walk us through your general playbook when you operate an asset. If you're taking something over, what's kind of the systems, processes you put in place? And
you said the word, right? You said playbook. You have to have a playbook, or let's just define it as a business plan. Sometimes we call it an asset management plan, whatever it is. You have to have a plan that matches what you sold the investors. So if you sold the investors, or however you got your money, maybe it's your own money, and that's awesome if it is, but likely you're taking outside dollars to take down this large multifamily property. If that's the case, you gave them an offering memorandum, you pitched them on this idea that we're going to move rents on the ones and twos up $100 and on the threes up $150 through our efforts in operations and through renovations. You better have a plan that is very detailed, that shows exactly how you're going to do that and lay it out plainly, because you got to take that underwriting, that pro forma, and then you have to go create an operating budget, and you have to go in and you have to explain this to the people that are going to run the asset. So when we buy a deal, well before we take it over and own it, we have an asset management plan put together. And when we buy the deal that day, we sit down with the on-site staff, the regional manager, and we walk through the whole plan together. And at the very end of every asset management plan, I have a signature block with all the key players' names, and everybody signs off. So if we said that we were going to replace the cabinet fronts on the units that we're renovating, it's going to be this cabinet front, and there's a picture in there. And if anybody goes outside of that, I'm going to say, what are you doing? You know, you didn't follow the asset management plan. Or if we're $25 below the rent that's specified in the asset management plan on our renewals or on our new leases, I'm going to say, what's going on? You know, didn't you follow the asset management plan? Now, if there's any amendments that need to be made to the asset management plan, all parties have to sign off. So if we want to raise rents another $50, okay, let's all agree that's a good idea. So you have to have a playbook. So going into a property, you absolutely have to have that plan going forward. What are you going to do?
And now, is there anything that you typically do to increase other income at your properties?
Of course. Yeah. Right now, perfect case scenario. We have a 120 unit, 2013 built multifamily product. And you know, there's not really value add that we can do, you know, like going in and renovating this unit. It already has granite in it. It's very nice. They built them well. So where do we get the rent lift? Well, operationally, we're going to raise the rents, and then through other income. And they're not charging right now for like pest control, for example. They're not billing that back. They're doing trash and water and sewer and rubs and such, but there's also cable and internet that the property's paying for, but they're not billing anything back to the residents. So we'll start billing back cable and internet as well.
Okay.
So those are a few examples. You can charge for parking. You could, you know, take some dollars and some capital and maybe do some covered parking and charge a bit more for that. The other thing we're doing in this case is there's 120 units and none of them have washers and dryers owned by the property. So with every new lease, we're going to offer a set of washers and dryers for an extra $60 a month. So those are some of the ways that we increase the other income.
And then anything on the managing utility expenses?
You know, there's a number of things as far as managing the expenses, like bringing them down. Is that what you're saying?
Correct. Yeah. Just monitoring.
Yeah. Monitoring. So if you're going with like a Freddie product or a Fannie product, they oftentimes offer what's called like a green rewards program, where you might get like 250 to 500 basis points off your interest rate if you sign up for this program. And it requires you to come in with a little bit more upfront capital. But you put new aerators in the shower heads and in the faucets, So your, you know, gallons per minute goes significantly down, and you're not using as much water when you're showering. Low flow toilets, LED light bulbs, things like that. There's many things that you can do at the property to take down the energy costs. Now, just on an operational level, if you're not doing the Green Awards program or anything like that, the major issues we see is if you have a property that has some vacancy, go walk all those units. And that's something you should do anyway. So if you have 100 units and you're at 95%, you have five vacant units, which isn't high vacancy now that I say that, but let's say you had 10 vacant units. You need to go walk all those units. And the first thing you should do when you walk in the units is feel for cold air. Like, is the AC on, right? Is the light on? Is the fan running, right? Because that vacant electricity all hits your, that all hits you as the owner. And what happens is, you know, the staff will go in and tour it with somebody, and they won't flip the lights off or turn the AC off when they leave. And so it runs for 4 days. Well, no one's in there, right? So those types of things can help you with saving on energy. The common areas, a lot of times in older properties, you have photocells that will go missing. And so you'll show up and it's 11 o'clock and there's lights on the exterior. You know, nothing makes me more angry than that type of stuff. So you just have to make sure you fix things like that. So.
And then what about delinquency? That's been a problem that's plagued us over the past 2 years with COVID. So any thoughts on how to attack that?
You know, that's a tough question. The thing I found is either your management company, whether you're self-operator and you self-manage or you're third party, it's almost like a culture. You know, either you're hard on collections and you really push them or you don't. And I like working with property management companies that is like their number one priority is occupancy and collections. Because if you don't have the occupancy where it needs to be, you have nothing to collect. but sure. if they focus on those two metrics, you always have cash coming in, which will allow you to go in and turn the units that become vacant and operate the property and pay your bills on time. So I would say you just have to work with property management companies that they have systems in place that, you know, if someone's late the next day, you know, maybe there's like a 2 day grace period from the first, that they have a notice on their door, you know, or something like that. Like, and it sounds harsh, but you know, if you create a culture on your property of, we're okay with you paying late. Well, guess what? People are going to start paying late. And so you have to make sure you have a culture of, you know, this is a business we're running. Just like you have the expectation as if you go into, you know, Chipotle and you buy a burrito, you've got to pay for it before you eat it. You know, similarly, if you live in one of my apartments, you've got to pay to live there, you know? So, I mean, you have to have that management company or whoever's on site really bought into that. And that's tough. But it is the business we're in.
Yeah. Well said. And then in terms of renewal rates, anything that, you found effective in terms of renewal packages for residents?
You know, it depends on the area you're in. And the you know, the type of class asset that you're working with. But, you know, people appreciate the little things. So if your goal is to retain people, which it should be, and you're hiking up rents, it's hard to just say, you know, we're going to hike up your rent. And in some areas you can say, well, if you don't want to pay, just leave. Someone else will come in, you know, which it's a business, right? But if you're trying to build a community, which you ought to be, and you want people to like living there and you want them to bring their friends, little things go a long way. So answering work service order requests quickly is probably the biggest one. Like if they have a light bulb that goes out and they call you, just go out and get it done that day. Don't let them build up, you know, or a leaking faucet, like the little things that are easy to fix. Just be attentive to them and make sure that the on-site staff is being attentive to them. Community events are important. One of our properties did a movie night for back to school, and there was popcorn and pizza, and they kind of were around the pool, and that was really fun for them. Sometimes if you're trying to get a big renewal bump, like $100 or something, you'll offer them, I don't know, like paint a wall for free, or, you know, maybe you change their blinds to the faux wood blinds or something like that. Something, you offer something. So.
And then anything that has particularly stuck out as really influencing someone's decision to renew or not?
Yeah, I mean, a big one is, do they enjoy the people they live around? You know, if you've allowed, you know, folks under your property that are troublemakers or something like that, then, you know, your other residents will grow to resent that, and they'll just leave, they'll move elsewhere. So depending on the class of asset that you're in, you just got to be really careful and incentivize people to bring their friends over to move in, to be their neighbors, you know? So we'll do a referral bonus of some sort, you know, if someone refers a friend, which helps people stick at the property a little longer. But commonly people move out just because they weren't taken care of.
Sure.
That's the biggest thing.
And now, you know, for you all, are you using third-party management, or are you self-managing some of your deals?
We do both. I have a pretty hard line in the sand when it comes to self-management, that I don't go into markets that I don't know.
Okay.
You know, if I'm going to buy a property in Nashville, which we did recently, just north of Nashville, I'm not going to go and property manage that. I don't know anybody there. I have no people I can call from the past and say, hey, where are you at now? Come work for me. I don't have any foothold in Nashville. If I had some more economies of scale there, maybe a different story. But, you know, we have a 258 unit project over there. I'm not going to go manage it just to make a 3% fee. It would really come at the cost of us managing that project well. So on properties that are kind of outside of our immediate area, we third party it, and we don't always use the same management company. We try and find the local expert that, you know, is really going to give us their attention. So that usually doesn't mean we use the biggest management company either. So anything around us, we do, we manage some of our newer stuff that we're building. And then we have a project down in Austin that we self-manage.
Okay.
So
how does it, you know, whether you self-manage or third-party manage, impact how your asset management and your operations?
Oh, you know, what I found is when you self-manage, you just become a property manager. You go right into regional manager role. It's no longer high level, you know, experience. It's in the weeds. It's resident concerns. It's, you know, I would tell most people to avoid property management because it will limit you on the amount of units you can buy, usually, unless you make it someone else's problem. But it always filters up. We have a management company, and, you know, the problems still filter up to Glenn and I that normally wouldn't if we just third party managed it out, you know. So I guess it depends on, like, how important is having that consistent income come into your business to help grow your business. And a lot of people say it's worth it because they're able to get a few more people on staff and such. But for us, we found that it's not necessarily worth it for us to do. So as far as asset management, I need to answer your question. Excuse me. We become property managers, not asset managers, when we property manage our own. And that's a bit difficult to where, to delineate the lines, you know, and it sucks you into property management, basically. So,
and then you had touched upon a little bit technology and so forth. What technology and systems do you processes do you use?
No, man. We on the syndication side, we use a company called Syndication Pro.
Okay.
Jacob Blackett and that group over there. It's a great software to run your syndications through. I would say if you're doing, you know, more than two or three deals a year, it makes sense to buy it. You can send out investor updates. You can push out K-1s. You upload the project. It creates kind of an online Rolodex of investors. It's a cool software. So we use that. We also use a text messaging software called Via. And we text message our investors to touch base with them on projects that they're involved in, and also to send out notifications of like financials and just to give them updates via text messages, because people open text more than emails. So, and then usually on the sites, we've used Entrata or Resman as far as our property management software. I'm partial to either one. I don't really like Yardi or some of these other. I think some of them are kind of archaic and too complicated. As far as an ownership level, I just like simple and I can just get to things quickly. So.
Okay. And then in terms of the weekly calls with the properties, what does the sample agenda look like for that? What topics do you go through?
So generally speaking, I don't do weekly calls with the property unless they're below like if they're below like 90% economic occupancy, then I'll start having those phone calls with them weekly. Really, I try to do the thing that I found best with asset management is not to always be in the hair of the property manager and the regional manager, because what can happen is their focus can shift from the property to you. And really you want their focus on the property. You want them taking care of the property. And there's ways you can figure out that they're taking care of the property without having to talk to them. You can go do a site visit and that's very clear quickly whether they're taking care of the property or not. And I would recommend you do those unannounced. But as far as these weekly calls go, if they are under 90% economic occupancy, we walk through the rent roll. A box score is usually what I pull. We go through the units, and you can, on most softwares, you can tell how long they've been vacant. And then there's this big question mark. Why has this been vacant 120 days? You know, how is that possible? And then the next time that I go to the property, I make it a point to go walk all those vacancies, because a lot of times, I mean, this is just reality. I love all you property managers. I have great friends in property management, and there's good and bad with every property management. But the good ones always stay on top of things, and they're very honest. They tell you exactly what's happening. The bad ones, they lie to you, and they mislead you, and they'll put in a report that a property's ready, made ready, but it's not, and you go walk it, and it smells bad, and the carpet's dirty, and you know, the blinds are crooked and all this stuff. And like, no wonder you haven't sold this unit, you know?
Sure.
I mean, I make it a point to go through the box score and just look at those things specifically. So
any other KPIs that you focus on?
Something that I look at every month on every property that we own, and it's a laborious task. People don't like doing this, but I'm telling you guys, this is like the key to your success. Is you've got to form some sort of spreadsheet that you look at every unit every month. So you need to go through unit by unit, look at the renewals, look at the new move-ins, and see where they're moving people in at. If you have like a 300 unit property, for example, and you go visit the property, and you're like, how are we doing with rents? And the property manager's like, oh, we've increased them $75 a month. We've done it with, you know, 10 of them. I would caution you to believe that. I would caution you to really dive in and figure it out for yourself. I've been burned way too many times to just believe the first thing I hear. First of all, those property managers are so nervous. They don't know what they're saying. They just want you to leave. They're like, just get out of my hair. So what I do is I go through And I have the, on one of my spreadsheet, I have the rental rate that is the unit's currently at. And when a new person moves in, I have the rental rate that they moved in at or renewed at, and the increase over the previous that was, and a percentage in a dollar basis. So I can always just be monitoring, are we going up or down? And how much are we going up? How close are we to hitting our pro forma? You know, if you're always waiting for the next month's financials to come out to look at the loss to lease, you're playing a month behind. That's kind of tough. So the KPI I always look at is the rent roll and some sort of formula that you figure out to see where it's moving. So
where the lease trade outs are, renewal rates.
Yeah. You've got to know that. And if you don't, then, and you don't know what they're leasing them down the road, then likely what will happen is you told them to lease them at 50. They said, no, we can do it at 60. And they're actually doing it at $25 a month. So you've got to be all over that.
And then in terms of leasing consultants and training them, how involved do you get in that?
Not a ton. I mean, on the properties that we manage, we definitely do. You know, it's all about sales. I do a lot of training just with managers when I'm there, just because there's key principles that you can use with any site visit to really figure out the tell of what's going on at the property. Maybe I could dive into one of the methodologies I use. I don't know if that's okay with you.
Yeah, that'd be great.
Something that I learned in IREM, IREM's the Institute of Real Estate Management. And I took the CPM courses and got my certified property manager degree because, or designation, because I really wanted to understand property management. And one thing that they hit home in there is you go through the four P's of property management: you people, product, price, and promotion. And when you go and do a site visit, if you're always looking at people that are working for you, the product that they're trying to sell, you know, the price, is the price comparable to the market? Is it way under? Is it way over? Is it right where it needs to be? And then how they're promoting it, what's their marketing look like? You know, what I guess concessions are we giving, right, to lease those? If you do those four things every time you go on site, you will have great success, and you'll have so many opportunities to teach leasing agents and property managers what you want, right? And as a property management company, their goal should be to meet your goals, right? So if it's important for you, for a leasing agent, and I know Darren, who I think you heard me on his podcast.
Yes.
One thing that was super important for him was every time someone walked into the leasing office that they stand up and greet that person.
Sure.
And, you know, if that's really important to you, you need to state that standard and follow up. So
sure it's happening.
It gives you opportunity to say, okay, you know, one of the P's, the people. You know, do I have a leasing agent when I ask him or her to do something because it's important to me, do they do it? And if they don't, it's probably not the right person on the bus. So you may have to change those people out.
No, well said. And then in terms of marketing, what have you found to be the most effective marketing strategies for your properties?
Oh, man. You know, the least effective form of marketing is not doing anything. And I've seen that a lot. So, you know, the most effective form I've found is word of mouth. You know, if you create a great community and great people bring other great people to your community, that's, you know, essentially free. Drive-by traffic can't be replaced. So if you're at a property that has really high traffic, you got to make sure your curb appeal is nice. And if your curb appeal is nice and you got some signs out now leasing, you know, or whatever it may be, it looks inviting, then you'll likely be full. If you're kind of in the back of a neighborhood or something like that, you really got to make some efforts through your online marketing. Apartments.com is very effective. And, you know, some areas like Facebook or Craigslist, you know, depending on the type of unit you're selling, those might be just as good as well. So you just got to know who you're selling to.
Mike, you had talked about some assets you self-manage, some you third party. So, and then you're asset managing effectively all of them. How do you work on the business, but not in the business, given your position?
That's a good question. That's, you know, it's hard not to work in the business a lot of the times. A lot of people use, you know, terms like, you know, give me the high level. I want the 30,000 view look, 30,000 foot view. As an asset manager, your calling really is to be in the business. And so if you're an owner that's an asset manager, if you don't want to be in the business, you better find someone to do the asset management for you. Because as an asset manager, you, if you're not in the business, you're not asset managing. I can tell you that right now. So you're, although you're probably not down changing out flappers and toilets, which I've done before, but, or, you know, replacing doorknobs and changing out keys and that type of stuff, you know, you're down meeting the site at the site with the people there, you're going through rents, you're going through renewals, you're talking about vacancy, you know, you're looking at units, and you should be doing that regularly. So, as an owner, once you hit a certain level, it's probably a good idea if you want to continue growing your portfolio that you hire an asset manager to come in and work for you. And you train that asset manager to do exactly what you would do. And then you just follow up with him and you still go visit the sites, you know, just maybe not as frequently. So it's just a progression.
Sure. Sure. And at what unit count do you, would you mentally say is now's the time to hire?
I think if you have more than 10 properties, and just because they're smaller unit counts doesn't mean they have less complexity. You know, I found like a 40 unit deal to be just as complicated as a 180 unit deal, sure, just because you don't have an on-site manager there. So, I would say that at 10 properties or something like, let's call it 1,000 units or 1,200 units, you probably have enough asset management fees coming in at that point to where you could afford to bring on an asset manager and have that person, you know, doing a lot of like the investor reporting, meeting with people at the site, and filling out, you know, the spreadsheets or whatever KPIs you use to track the property.
Sure.
And I would just recommend you hold a once a week asset management meeting with that person.
Got it. No, well said. If we turn to acquisitions, so yeah, it sounds like you've acquired a few deals recently. What is your investment criteria?
It's a great question. I feel like we've jumped a little all over lately. A criteria for us is a good deal. And people,
what qualifies a good deal?
One that cash flows. No, I'm just kidding. I mean, that sounds silly, but people are buying stuff on 2.75 cap rate, you know, it's insane. But a good deal for us would mean right now is we've become more of long-term hold guys. We're looking for, you know, durable yield, just coupon clipping assets. And we'll mix in one or two or three value add deals in the mix of that a year, which usually we put bridge debt on and we hold for 18 months to 2 years. Okay. So a good deal for us would probably be north of 100 units. Going in, the property cash flows. We're not really buying for appreciation. We're buying for cash flow, which gives us some good cushion. Is in and around Central Texas.
Okay.
We're focusing more on the periphery of these growing markets. So for example, if we're in Austin, which that's where I live, we're looking at Leander, Liberty Hill, Taylor, Round Rock, Hutto, you know, Manor. We're looking all around the city, but not inside the city. We're not really interested in buying, you know, on a two cap in Austin right now.
Okay.
We'll let someone else do that. So
sure, sure. Anything that gets you really excited when a deal comes across your desk?
Oh man, there's a lot. Yeah. If I see at stabilization, we're gonna be north of 10% cash on cash, I'm pumped, because that gives me something really to push towards and work towards. Because ultimately, you know, as we build our portfolio, that cash flow is just going to be coming in like crazy. So I really look at just the cash flow. I mean, and on these value add deals, you've got to have an open mind that you can reposition it. And right now, you know, rather than renovating 100% of the units or 50% of the units, we're doing like a quarter of the units and just selling the, you know, the story to the next guy, and that's working. So I would say the cash flow is really what gets me excited, if anything. So.
Okay. Anything that's used to quick screen deals?
Yeah, we have a smell test model that we'll plug in and just make sure the metrics all kind of hit and work. But we really like to get out on the site and see the asset with our own two eyes. Okay. So if the smell test works, we're out there probably the next day or two looking at the asset. Mm-hmm.
Any automatic deal killers for you? It's kind of dead on arrival items.
Oh, flat roofs. No, we'll do flat roofs. But usually that's a tough one. No, we've done some hairy deals, man. We did a deal up in around Fort Hood and Killeen, and okay. The project was stripped of all its copper and wiring. There's grass growing in the parking lot. Every window is boarded up.
Wow.
And we bought it from the bank, and they carried a note back, the 100% of the note back, and we brought money for renovations. Wow. And we went in and we fixed everything. We filled it up and we sold it. And, you know, so we've dealt with some pretty crazy stuff. I mean, deal killers would just be like, you know, if they're making crazy assumptions that have no validity to them and they're just pulling it out of thin air. I mean, I don't buy on, you know, made up assumptions. So okay. I need to see some physical proof that you're achieving what you're selling.
Nice.
That's a deal.
And then as you're looking at deals and bidding on deals, any tips on how to win broker attention and win deals?
Broker attention. I would say stay in touch with the brokers often, call them, you know, if you don't win a deal, call the broker right afterwards and say, hey man, super disappointed. I didn't win the deal. I would love to be a good backup offer and I can come up a little bit if needs be, we have money ready to go. So you're always in the back of their mind. Take them out to lunch, you know, meet up with brokers, just build a rapport with them. It's just like anything else. Because once the market softens a little bit, brokers are going to be hungry for business again. Right now they're just being fed. Yeah. They don't care about you. So, you know, they'll want, you know, those relationships again. So I would say just keep in contact with them and then make sure you always, you know, I would say do the right thing. If you have a good broker that sold you a property at a good price, when you go to sell it, just always go back to them. I mean, the biggest way to burn a bridge with a broker is to go back with another broker, you know, for no good reason. So, you know, take care.
I appreciate that, Mike. Yeah, that's all points well taken. For development, you know, why did your team decide to get into development?
That's real simple. In Austin, in and around where we are at, like I said, the cap rates are so low. Units are trading at historical highs per door. So we bought a 1972 built duplex project in Austin. We bought it for $145 a door. We renovated 15 of the units, and we're going to take it back to market for $225 a door.
Amazing.
In 1 year. Okay. Wow. So rental growth here is 25% last year. It's insane. And so as I'm looking at construction costs, although they've gone up pretty significant, if you bought the land at a fair price and you're able to control those costs, we're building units all in around 175, 180 a unit. So
class A amenity.
Brand. And we don't usually do like amenitized product. We try and come in below the institutional level deals. We'll do like 130 unit, 150 unit garden style apartment. And maybe there's a swimming pool, maybe not, maybe some covered parking, but we don't do like the massive fancy leasing offices with a bunch of wasted space and, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars in interior decorating. We don't, we try and come in just at a lower rental threshold, but it's a brand new unit. So people love it because it's not as much as the class A, but.
Would you say it's class A workforce housing or?
Yeah, probably like class A workforce housing.
Okay.
You know, or I would say that's probably the product that we're building. So, nice new stuff, great community, great areas, but not over amenitized. And we're building that stuff probably all in, like I said, at 175, 180 a unit.
Yeah, that's amazing. And that's land, everything included.
Yeah. So, you know, it sounds great, but development is so hard.
Well, tell us what's hard about it.
Oh my gosh. Around every corner, you know, there's a major problem. It's not usually just like a quick fix. It's like, this is going to take time and money to fix. And maybe a lot of money. Glenn and I have a 50 unit project over in Leander we're building right now, and it's coming along great now, but we closed the loan in August of 2020. And between August of 2020 and January of 2021, there was like a 400% increase in lumber costs. Wow. So you can imagine, you know, the general contractor was coming back to us saying, guys, I can't eat this. This is $1 million change order.
Sure.
So the question becomes, who pays for that? And the bank says, well, Glenn and Mike, you guys should, you know? And, you know, ultimately, I was able to convince the bank that because rental rates have gone up so much, the property's worth more now. So we got a new appraisal done at the new rates through market survey. And we did prove that, right? But they only lent us at 75% loan to cost or 70% loan to cost. So there was $300,000, $350,000 that we had to go put into the deal. So, I mean, that wasn't fun.
Sure. Well, that's tough. I mean, that's extreme situation.
But, you know, around every corner, there's more money that needs to be put into it. Finding good partners that are willing to take the risk with you is also difficult. So you have to have some capital behind you. And that's usually why it limits a lot of folks to getting into it, just because they need to build that capital before they can get in there. So
what advice do you have for people getting into the business, both passive and first-time investors?
For first-time investors, I would say just make sure you know your sponsor. Make sure you know who you're working with. There's good and bad sponsors. I've met fantastic people that I try and model what I do after them. You know, so be careful about who you invest with. Just make sure you vet them out. Make sure they have experience. And unless there's some guy that's starting out and you trust them and you want to take the risk, maybe just ask for a little more of the upside. That's fair. So, and if you're looking to do your first time, like syndication, is you just got to dive in and make it happen. You've got to look at all angles, find a partner to take on, find someone more experienced to help you and mentor you through the process. Be willing to give up a piece of the pie and listen to these people. You know, you've got to take the risk. As Mark Cuban says, you got to have the balls to make the baby. So if you don't, you're not going to ever do it. So I don't know what else to say other than go get it done. You know, find someone to lend you the money for your earnest money if you have to, you know, just work it out. That's what we do. You know, the biggest advice I could give to somebody is when you see these fees that maybe are attached with a deal and, you know, all this money, don't lie to yourself and tell you it's a good project. Tell yourself it's a good project just because of the potential of fees or whatever. The amount of heartache and headache that you'll create for yourself 3 months, 4 months down the road when the rubber meets the road is so much greater than not having that fee is worth. So I would say just don't lie to yourself when you're underwriting. That is such a mistake that so many people make. And then you have investors that won't trust you, and you'll have probably failed if the market didn't save you, which it is a lot of people. You'll probably have failed to some degree and wish you wouldn't have. So I would just say, make sure you don't lie to yourself. Just be honest. And if you have to walk away from a project, walk away. If you have to lose some earnest money, lose it. But don't get yourself into a position where it's like, you know, this project was not worth doing. So I would say that's one of the biggest lessons. The other one would be pick your partners very carefully. Make sure you're getting into partnership with someone that you know and trust. A lot of people suggest you don't get into partnership with family or friends. Maybe you have the wrong family and friends. I trust my friends and family explicitly. I have a small group of friends that I've known for my whole life, and I trust them with anything. So, you know, you have to find people, and this is really what I'll say is you have to find people that care more about you than they do about the money. And you have to care more about them than you do about the money. And if you care more about the person than the money, you can work out anything. But if you care more about that money than that person, dude, that partnership is done from the beginning, because hard times will come and true colors will be shown. So pick a partner that values friendships and relationships over dollars. So that's another piece of advice. Maybe I'll just give two.
Yeah, that's great. Well, those are well taken. Appreciate it. How can listeners get in touch with you?
We have a website, obsidiancapitalco.com. You can go on there and you can log on. You can create an account in our portal. So it puts you in as an investor in one of our deals. Or when we send out one of our deals, you'll get an email. Or you can email me directly, mike@obsidiancapitalco.com. Happy to chat with anyone. So yeah, email me.
Mike, thank you so much for your time. This was great. And I'm sure a lot of people will get a lot out of it. So thank you again.
Thanks for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to Multifamily Rockstars. We hope this episode was helpful for your personal and professional growth. For more episodes and to learn more about investing in multifamily apartments, check out LifeChangingCapital.com.